Welcome to the podcast of National Institute of Chemistry. You can relax and pour yourself a favorite drink from a nearby Erlenmeyer flask, beaker, oops, cup, because the days of complex scientific reading are behind us. We are here to provide you with engaging and accessible explanations of the latest discoveries. In this episode, I'm hosting Clement Mezget from the Department of Synthetic Biology and Immunology at the National Institute of Chemistry, who will introduce us to groundbreaking advancements in modular protein engineering. Hi, Clement. Thanks so much for joining us in this podcast.
Thank you very much.
I would love to start by asking you, how did you first get involved in protein engineering and what excites you the most?
Okay, so first time I started with protein engineering at the beginning of my PhD journey. Basically, the whole idea behind my PhD was to design novel proteins which would recreate nature and then build something new from these building blocks. And I think this is very exciting field because it's not just, let's say, scientific, but it's also can be applied to different biotechnological industrial applications, which is also very important for a bit more broader community and also understanding what can we do with this kind of proteins to build something new, to explore the nature a bit more and try to get the best from both worlds, from the nature and also from modern engineering, let's say, tools and also applications. And of course, to use these to advance the, everyday tools or some specific tools for specific needs in biotechnology, therapeutics, industry, and so on. Mm. Yeah. So that would be, the main.
It's a good motivation to have something that is basic research, but still very applicable in the future, soon future,
Yes, definitely. I think this is the biggest driver for me because mm-hmm. I'm not so much just into this basic science, but I prefer to have at least some goal in, let's say, also not in the closer future, but also in the, let's say, medium future that something could be applied to some real world scenarios.
Yeah. Mm. Is there something in this field that you find particularly surprising, maybe mind-blowing? Did you have some aha moment while you were researching?
Yeah, I think the biggest aha moment, or let's say the biggest surprisement, was that these tools, which are driven by AI, can predict proteins so well. So they can predict protein structures, let's say AlphaFold, which came out in 2021, I think, AlphaFold 2, which was really groundbreaking in terms of that you can model every protein, basically, also if it does not have crystal structure. And based on that, you could really model everything what you would like, because my proteins, which are used in my study, in our study, they didn't have crystal structure. So without crystal structure, it's hard to model something on a new way, because you do not have like precise positioning of amino acids. You do not know how these amino acids are being folded into secondary, tertiary structure, etc. So it was really great advancement, because based on that, we were able to precisely predict, or let's say, as much as possible, how those proteins would behave in terms of structure. And therefore, it was easier for us to develop some new self-assembling structures, which is very important for this kind of big things which we were building in the paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this paper we are discussing today is the result of a collaboration between researchers from the National Institute of Chemistry, National Institute of Biology, and Institute Josef Stefan, titled Coupling of Spectrin Repeat Modules for the Assembly of Nanorods and Presentation of Protein Domains. And the expert opinion was provided by Professor Dr. Wilfred Weber, Head of Material Synthetic Biology at Leibniz Institute for New Materials.
In this study, she also successfully engineered molecular protein blocks inspired by the spectrin repeat modules of dystrophin, and she achieved self-assembly into nanoscale rigid rods with adjustable spacing. They achieved precise control over the assembly and disassembly processes using cold demerization, an approach in which the research group is among the international leaders. This work advances bottom-up protein engineering and provides a versatile platform for the spatially organized presentation of functional proteins or biologically active peptides, with potential implications for biomedicine, biomaterials, and nanotechnology.
Clement, could you please describe the research field that this paper touches on?
Yeah, so the main field is basically modular protein engineering in combinations with tools of synthetic biology. What is important here? So we were basically inspired by human dystrophin. Human dystrophin is one of the biggest proteins in human body, which is involved in maintaining muscle integrity. So they're very important fibril proteins. And any kind of pathology in these kind of proteins could lead also into diseases such as Duchenne muscle dystrophies, etc. But nevertheless, we had a bit more of engineering goal. So these proteins are behaving as a fibers, which are very important with those mechanoelastical properties. And we wanted to recreate something with building blocks which are present in these natural proteins outside the cells, so in vitro. And we wanted to recreate that those building blocks which would be engineered into something which would be very similar as the original protein which is present in the human cells. So we basically did some kind of reverse engineering of human dystrophin. So we wanted to produce artificial fibers, and those artificial fibers, which are based on human dystrophin, but also de novo designed synthetic biology tools like coiled coils, which could couple those dystrophin modules into bigger fibers. So basically, we took one part of the dystrophin, we rearranged the surface, we added those coiled coil peptides, which we developed in-house in our laboratory, which is also one of our specifics. A lot of very prestigious papers was published based on this topic from our house, from our department. And we prepared those modular building blocks, which can then basically on demand self-assemble into structures which are resembling initial structure from the human body. So basically, this is the topic which is covering protein engineering, synthetic biology, and also bio-nanotechnology. Because at the end, we have fibers which are nanotechnological tool in micrometer scale, which could be used for other applications. Let's say you could present different proteins on those fibers. Those proteins could be antigens for vaccine development. They could be enzymes for developing catalytic cascades, biosensors, if there would be some binding domains on it. So there are a lot of potential applications. But I think the most important part is that we took something which was never explored before, because there is no, as I'm aware of, there is no similar structures to be described so far in the literature, that somebody took really those domains and coupled it in a, such a way as we did to perform this reverse engineering of this kind of protein-based fibers, which are artificial. And of course, they could be also used to as an alternative of classic textile fibers, which is also one very rapidly developing field for more sustainable, let's say, way of living. Not to have just polymer-based artificial fibers, plastic ones.
Yeah, so the key motivation was really to create
Some material
yes. Which is can be very useful in such many diverse fields.
Yes, and it's also very nice because it can be simply produced in bacteria. So the production, it's very straightforward. And then the self-assembly, now it's already very optimized, so you could really get those micrometer fibers. But you could then also, of course, our goal is to go also to macro scale, not just to micro scale, but there is quite a lot of advancements also there in that field, so there is also potential application in that direction.
Okay, so this can really be applied in many fields. And how does the research look like? How are you researching, working on this project?
Yeah, so the work is basically compiled of wet lab, but also quite a bit of computational things. At the beginning, of course, we had to set up this challenge. So what we would like to achieve with those proteins and how to achieve these goals. So a lot of studying the literature. So what could be done, how could be done, how to combine different elements, let's say these repeats which we used from dystrophin together with those coil-coil peptides, how to combine them together to get something which is rigid enough that would reassemble into fibers. And then, of course, a lot of protein modeling, because you prepare those designs, which in theory should look like something which you would like to have, let's say to like this 3D printed stuff, which I will explain you later. And then, of course, with these models, you can see which protein candidates would be used for this structure assembly. And then we order DNA, which is encoding these proteins, which we designed in the first place. And then, of course, we have to clone those DNAs into expression vectors. Those expression vectors are used for expressing proteins in bacterial cells. And then we produced, so we expressed and produced the proteins in bacterial cells. There was quite a lot of different variants. We had to purify them with a lot of different processes, but mostly based on chromatographies. And then, of course, the biggest goal was at the end. We had to know how each individual protein looked like. So we used a lot of biophysical characterization, from secondary structure prediction, molecular mass, molecular weights, etc. And then we combine them together. So each individual module does not have any, let's say, higher order structure. It's just a small one. But then if you put them together, similar as a Lego block, you would get larger structures. And then we combine them together in different combinations, try to find which one is the best, and with microscopical tools, mostly atomic force microscopy, negative stain transmission electron microscopy, and also TIRF fluorescence microscopy, we were checking whether those combinations were resulting in the fibers, which were basically our initial idea of the whole study. So it's basically from everything, from studying the literature to molecular modeling of protein blocks, and then, of course, cloning, producing all the proteins, characterizing, and then seeing what were the results. And then, of course, iteratively change something if it doesn't work in between.
First, when you have the DNA, you put it in the bacteria. The bacteria produces these proteins. Yeah. And you said then you're trying to put them together. So each bacteria, I mean, each DNA is has the information for one type of block.
Yes.
Uh-huh, and then you isolate and then you combine these blocks together.
Yes.
And yeah, okay. So this, the bacteria is producing the different blocks. Lego.
Yes.
And then you are combining them together in the some solution and then look under the microscope to see how they
combine. Because this is one of the biggest selling points for us. Because if you would like to have just one building block, that just one building block would self-assemble already inside the bacteria. So let's say that one fiber would be built just from one Lego block. That's extremely hard because most probably it would be forming large structures already in bacteria. And this is very toxic to bacteria. And also it's extremely hard to isolate it because most probably it would be insoluble. So insoluble things are extremely hard to get them back soluble. So everybody who is working with recombinant proteins knows that. So for us, it's great because we wanted to design soluble small building blocks, which can be produced in very large quantities, cheaply, of course, with E. coli production. And then when you know that each building block is as it should be, then you can just combine them together and get larger structures with your, let's say, control over as much as possible conditions as possible. Because in cells, it's hard to control the stuff. But here you have much more control.
And how long does this kind of experiments last?
So are we talking about the whole study or just...
Yeah, let's say probably one experience in the wet lab takes a month or two, but also the how long do you do the modeling, the studying? So all together, or maybe you describe each one like approximately. So we have an imagination that for the final paper you needed 1 year, 2-3 years.
Yeah. Okay. So the final paper was, let's say, conducted in 1.5 year. But here the catch is that I was working on proteins before, on a bit different proteins, which are also from one human proteins, but they were beta globular proteins. So they were much more complicated. And I was working on that for 3.5 years. And it was very hard to work with them. And then I shifted the focus on these proteins, which are a bit different. They're alpha helical, they have different topology, but I had a lot of knowledge and experience from before. This is why this study was conducted in a relatively short period of time for such a good impact publication. But if I combine this together, so 3.5 plus 1.5 year, it's 5 years, okay? So it's quite a lot of knowledge and also a lot of multidisciplinary, let's say, collaboration with people who know different expertise. But let's say if we take the whole procedure from modeling to first results, I would say it could take, ideally, of course, let's say 1.5, 2 months, let's say 2 months. Mm-hmm. But of course, never everything is ideal, especially here in science, because you work something which was never explored before, mostly. So it could be much, much longer. But I must say that this previous experience with those harder proteins gave me a lot of insights. And also with this collaboration with other people from National Institute of Biology, Jozef Stefan Institute, and also a lot of our in-house knowledge, especially from, of course, Roman, then Jakas, Noya, Yasia, Lisa, who are also co-authors. We were able to push this forward and, let's say, get good results with not so many, many different variants to test in the first place.
Yeah, I think it always comes out that these collaborations and sharing of knowledge is so important. And also this fact that sometimes you work hard on something and you believe it was wasted, but it was never wasted because you learned so much for the next project.
I think this is one of the most important parts. So first, collaboration, of course, this is very important. And second is really that... science is hard, right? So it should be hard, because if it's easy, then everybody would do it and every novel stuff would be easily achieved. So that's, of course, it should be hard. Also with this basically previous experience, you get a lot of new knowledge, and this new knowledge would be, if not directly, indirectly, it would be applied anywhere. So I think this is very important. And a lot of that knowledge from my first project, which looked pretty much failed, but still, there was a lot of insights, like same insights, which were not like for a whole public good publication, but they were good for some technical expertise, whatever. And it was really a big help for the project. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice that you said science is hard, research is hard. It is sometimes. How do you personally balance this research life with a personal life to make it?
So really you need some kind of release valve. So definitely you need to have it. For me, that's sports, but also, so I like to be with people. There is quite a lot of social activities, but let's say sports is the most important factor for me. I played a lot of competitional football back in the days, prior to my PhD, because now it's a little bit hard to combine everything, but I'm still trying to play it recreationally. I also try to mountain bike a lot. I also take dancing classes as much as I can, of course, with my wife. Of course, you have to have some kind of release valve to balance it with science.
Yeah, I think it's interesting also that you can learn a lot from sports and put it in science, especially this organization, this push you need, this hard work in sports is also important if you want to achieve something and you're training and training and training till you win the game or something.
Yes.
In science, it's similar till you get the results.
Basically, it's very similar. because if you have a lot of negative results, you need to have something to keep you up. And also in sports, you have to be motivated because you should not always win, right? There is also quite a lot of times when you lose. So this is very important, yeah.
And a lot of research also is coming out on how important the sport is for our physical body, everything, but also our mental health and brain connection. So probably doing sports while doing research is good to have better ideas, fresh mind.
Definitely, definitely. Every time when I come after my football class, or not class, my football playing, I'm always very exhausted, physically exhausted. But next time, next morning when I wake up, I think, okay, it's very nice that I went, because I'm physically exhausted, but my mental, like, clearance of my mind is much, much brighter than it was before. So I think it's great.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, going back to the Lego blocks. Now that we have these Lego blocks, I also asked you that you bring something with you that maybe the listeners can see how it looks like, or something you used in the lab, and you chose to made a 3D printing of some of these blocks. Can you describe them?
Yes, I was thinking how to describe this study the most effectively. I could bring the photo in front of me, in front of the microscope, but it's quite hard for listeners to explain what that kind of thing is. So I prepared basically two building blocks, and those two building blocks were modeled with AlphaFold. And basically, then I was able to prepare model and then print it out. And there are two building blocks, and those two building blocks can alternatively connect together via those coiled coils, which is one of the part of this 3D printed model. And they could really connect into like a string or as a fiber. And in real life, one building block is 50 nanometers long. Here, this one is maybe 20 centimeters long, so you have to have this comparison. But if you combine a lot of them, we were able to get fibers which are 15 micrometers long. So this is much, much bigger. So you have to take into account how many those smaller building blocks were stacking together in a linear fashion to get those large building blocks.
So a lot,
yes,
yeah.
This would be similar if this is like 20 centimeters, it would be 10,000 times more than this number, which is how much? 20 times 1,000 is 200,000? No, 20,000 centimeters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is, that you were able to make even in micrometer long in the lab, it's a big achievement, because these small nanometer structures, and that they come to the micrometers, there are so many things that could go wrong and go the wrong way until they are built that length. So this is probably one of the key results. What else are these key results that also other researchers can look upon?
Yeah, this is the fundamental result. So we were able to get this kind of long fibers. Okay, so next to that, we were able to basically confirm that these fibers can be used also for some kind of application in the future. And one of the most important parts of these fibers is also that each of those fibers is composed of two different building blocks. And each of those two building blocks can be functionalized with different protein, let's say. And it's very important to know at which distance you have those defined, presented domains in your filament. So they could be spatially arranged. And this is very important because with combination of different ratios of this individual building block in the fiber, we were able to tune the spacing between the presentation site inside the fiber. Which means that, let's say, we set each presented domain would be presented just on 35 nanometer spacing. And we were able to confirm that just with combining correct ratios of those two building blocks. But on the same time, we changed the strategy a bit and we said, okay, can we increase the spacing between those two presented domains on our building block? And yes, we basically increased the spacing by 2, which means that we changed the ratios a bit of those two building blocks, and we would be able to present those domains on the fibers, not with 35 nanometer spacing, but let's say with 75, 80 nanometer spacing. And this is very important because each building block is really, you could tune it to have it smaller or you would like to have it bigger. If it's bigger, means that it would be larger spacing between those two in the same chain, in the same filament. You could make it smaller, which means that you would have smaller spacing. You could change the ratio. You can have one building block which is bigger, one is smaller, or vice versa. So you could really tune the spacing between them. And this is important. If you would like to develop, let's say, enzymatic cascades, which means that you have different enzymes, which can basically affect one and another in a chain, and you bind them to the fiber, you start with first enzyme, which produces some resulting moiety, and then that resulting compound could basically start another enzyme, which is exactly, let's say, 30 nanometers down the road. And this could be like a self-sustainable cascade, which is very important, especially in engineering of enzymatic catalytic activity.
Yeah, you can place the enzymes exactly in the order and the length from each other as you wish.
Yes.
And then to have really optimized final product.
Yes, this is very important. Maybe another one, which is can be a bit more broader for different communities, would be also vaccine development. Some studies showed where they prepared, let's say, virus-like particles, where they presented antigens on a spacing of 20 nanometers, they were the most potent for activation of B-cell receptors. And here is the same story. We can really tune this spacing between the presented antigens, which we could put on a fiber. We could put them on a 20 nanometer spacing. Therefore, we would create basically vaccine-type structures, which would be more potent for achieving better immune response against those antigens which would be presented on the fibers. This is a very important aspect, which was not just making the fibers, because making the fibers is one, but you have to know how to use those fibers for something.
Yes.
And this was an important addition. Yeah.
Perfect. To have really applications in mind. Yeah. And you showed that this could be possible. And what were these main advancements now? Of course, everything you researched now, the other researchers can use your way of conducting the research. Is the methodology this main thing that will advance the field, or already the blocks, how they are built?
I think the blocks are the first place, because these blocks are from one fold, which is very important in cellular or human and also other species, which are important to build these cytoskeletons, etc. So these main building blocks, we basically define the rules how to design main building blocks to achieve this topology on a larger scale. Another important thing, which is also very important, is that they're highly modular, which means that they can be easily tuned, so it could be bigger, they can be smaller, they can be functionalized, they cannot be functionalized. They can also go in two dimensions, not just in one dimension, and it's easy because you can produce them in bacteria as a soluble protein separately. So these are probably the biggest selling points, and of course then that you can get large structures with a spatial defined positioning of protein domains on the structure on demand for different applications.
What do you think was the biggest limit of your work?
The biggest limit was definitely, or let's say not definitely, if you'd like to go to, let's say, to materials engineering to get larger, even larger materials, because if you would like to go to, let's say, production of biotextiles, you need not microscopic fibers, but you need eventually macroscopic fibers.
Yeah.
And the limitation here is this production, how to sustainably, cheaply, cheap enough, of course, get those larger structures.
Scale up,
yeah, of course. This is the biggest problem so far, but definitely if there would be interest to go in that way, there are ways how to overcome this. And maybe, of course, if you rely on microscopic tools, these are not really high throughput things. So when you go to a microscope, you need to sit, let's say, there for many, many hours. You need to be patient. You need to get nice images. This is something which is not really, which is in a contrary with AI, which can give us a lot of proteins. So we have a lot of proteins, yeah, but somebody has to test them, right?
Exactly. We still need the proof in the wet lab.
Yes, especially for this kind of macroscopical structures, because it's not just some easy functional assay or some ELISA or some luciferase taste or something like that. You need to sit on a microscope and you need to check.
And but you need to have the knowledge to do the microscopy.
That's for sure, yeah.
Either somebody else who is already has the knowledge to do it, or you need a lot of time to learn.
Yeah, that's very important. Also in our case, we had we had the collaboration with Jozsef Stefan Institute. There was Miha Škarabot, who was he's really experienced in atomic force microscopy. He basically showed me how to work with microscope. He was always available to help me with using the machine. And then I was able to get really nice images later. And of course, the help from National Institute of Biology, from Magda Tušek-Žnidarič. She's an expert for microscopy, TEM microscopy. And she knew how to really image biological samples, because this is a bit different. It's not similar as imaging of materials or something where you need to have like almost atomic structure. Here you need to go a bit more thinking about it's good enough. So you have to go from less magnification to check the whole place, screen it, find where those proteins are located, and then you start to go to dig into details. So you need to have approach which is way different than maybe microscoping some other stuff.
So, and if you're not doing this every day, you might not see, yes, but somebody who's doing it every day sees it,
of course,
quicker.
And then we observe that we have really a lot of very large structures. And first we were just focusing on very small fractions of surface, which were basically the surfaces between very large proteins, which were our proteins. But I was not experienced in that. So I was basically looking into debris in those structures which were not able to form big stuff. And then we went to look this from lower magnification, and we observed we have really big stuff, but we were not looking into it.
were looking too close.
Yeah, I was looking too close.
Yeah.
So it's really important to have people who are experienced and who have knowledge into some methodology, and then combine it together, and then it works well.
Yeah. Do you have some anecdotes to share with us, something funny or something less funny that happened to you during the research?
Yeah, I think this is connected with this, what I was talking right now. So until February or beginning of the March, I was a bit, we can get, let's say, 100, 200 nanometers long fibers. Still, it's like 10, 15 building blocks connected together. Okay, it's something,
nice,
right?
Result.
It's not bad. Yeah, it's nice. And then I got an email from Magda from National Institute of Biology that we have some fibers. And okay, I said, nice, let's see. They're probably 200 nanometers long, nice fibers. And then we checked that and we had like few micrometers, 5, 6, 7, 8 micrometers long fibers. And they were clearly built like ropes, which means that you have thin fibers, which can then also stack laterally to be like a rope-like structure, very big one, and also very long one, which is also energetically very favorable for every kind of thinner stuff to join together to build something which is much stronger. And then I said, okay, nice. So basically, everything which I was doing so far was too close to the surface. So I was checking just probably debris. Mm-hmm. And then I went back on AFM and I checked under low magnifications, and I also found a lot of fibers. They were intertwined also in such a knot similar as a hair. Mm-hmm. If you have long hair, you know what I'm talking about. And then we went also to fluorescence microscopy we can decorate them with neon green fluorescent proteins, and they were glowing green or red with red fluorescent proteins. So then, yeah, it went further to the publication.
Perfect. Looking back, would you do something differently, or would you advise something to the researchers going into this field?
Maybe differently, to have somebody who is experienced in, first, to have this knowledge or at least a bit of experience to design these kind of large structures. We had a bit of it, but without that previous project, would be very hard to build this kind of proteins as we did now. And another thing is that you have somebody who is really experienced in these characterization techniques, especially if you would like to build large assemblies like fibers, arrays, some particles, bigger particles. You need to have some experienced microscopist or some people who are working with similar stuff, maybe not designed, maybe natural, but it doesn't matter because the principles are the same.
Yeah. So to find some collaborators,
yes,
that have the experience, and
yes,
not to look too close if you want to see big.
Sure. Yeah. But you know, I was not so ambitious at the beginning because I thought, okay, 100
is science,
it's quite enough.
Each nanometer is like, wow.
It's better than nothing.
I thank you again for being the guest of this podcast, and congratulations for the really nice publication and work.
Thank you for the invitation, and
see you soon with the next new paper. Guest of the 8th episode of the Papers Illuminated Člankarnica podcast was Klemen Mezgec. We encourage you to tune in again next month as we explore fresh insights from a new paper.